Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. Thank you, Bernd Scherer, and your amazing team for the work done to organize this. Fantastic to be here. Great honor with Philippe Descola that I have read with great admiration for so many years. And dear audience, we are missing a paper. So between the more anthropological paper and mine, there should have been a paper on animal rights. Keep that in mind, because there's quite a jump to go from one to the other. I am definitely not a specialist of animals. In fact, my only qualification to speak about animals is that I am one, a human animal of the post-human kind, but that's about as far as it goes. So the argument that I want to run is slightly different, but it will come to similar conclusion, particularly on some resistance to the humanization of animal rights, this reparative humanism that comes in through legal frameworks that leaves me rather skeptical, I must say. I want to start from what I call the posthuman convergence, the convergence between posthumanism and post-anthropocentrism, critiques of man as homo universalis and critiques of anthropos as a dominant, aggressive, exploitative species. This convergence is not an abstract speculation. It is an effect of our historicity. It is an effect of the incredible scientific revolution that we are going through in the life sciences, in the advanced technologies, in stem cell, in nanotechnologies, in robotics, the great drive forward towards living systems, the containers for which are no longer humanoids in our great diversity, but networks, cells, the diffuse, distributed modes of being alive. This is an effect of our historicity. It is an effect of our context. It is the result of the brilliance of our science. And our science is not made by green little men who dropped in from Mars. It is made by us. And the universities and temples of knowledge, like the HKV, are at the heart of what is becoming known as cognitive capitalism. Capitalism that is a research-driven information society that trades on data about all that lives. So in saying that there is a displacement of the centrality of anthropos, I could be saying, he's already here, can't get rid of him, can we? I'm already saying with Deleuze and Guattari that the reterritorialization of contemporary capitalism are really focusing on data about living system. Life is the capital. Data, information, codes about living systems is the capital. Melinda Cooper, working in Sydney, calls it a life as surplus. Nick Rose, working from the UK, calls the politics of life itself. So if I talk about a convergence between a displacement of the centrality of the human and critiques of humanism, post-humanism, post-anthropocentrism, I am not dreaming of possible future worlds. I'm not talking about science fiction, although to a very large extent, science fiction is, since the Cold War, kind of foresaw some of these developments, predicted some of these developments. But I want to keep this very grounded according to the methodology of the politics of location, the immanence of power relation, which, as you know, if you know a little bit of my work, is what feminism has brought to the scientific communities, speak from situated positions, and politics of location. I think we are going through a massive posthuman turn. And as a result of this, the human-non-human relationships are being restructured as we speak. The animal that used to be one of the privileged terms of alterity, that was defined in a dialectical relationship to the human sovereign subject. That animal postulated as the other, and Philippe Descola spoke already about the Cartesian nightmare. Descartes really stayed awake having nightmares, and that maybe the bodies walking down the streets were not real humans. Maybe they were robots, maybe they were zombies. Just reread the fifth meditation with post-human eyes, and you will see that Descartes really was terrified by the non-human, and his dualism is a way of dealing in a very brutal but highly effective manner with the otherness of these non-human others who are reduced to a subhuman external sort of status. So the humanistic subject, but with more in a minute, postulates otherness as dialectically ordained to be non-human, non-white, non-male, non-normal, non-young, non-healthy, non-heterosexual. It's a minus one type of thinking. And I think animals have been caught in this to a very large extent, together with other categories of what I call pejorative otherness. The dialectics of difference work through processes by which sexualization, racialization, and naturalization produce devalorized categories of non-human, subhuman, infrahuman. Sexualization, the sexualized others, women, LGBT, others. Racialization, the ethnic, colonized, indigenous, others. Naturalization or ecologization, all the earth others, animal, plants, insects. All of these are categories not only of difference, but of negative difference. To be different from the sovereign human subject means to be worth less than the sovereign human subject. There is a hierarchy here that is a hierarchy of power, of entitlement, of symbolic presence, of access. And in fact, you could define the dominant humanistic anthropocentric subject as a subject that has given himself, and it is a him, the right of access of anybody on this planet. Anybody. All bodies are penetrable by the dominant and ruling anthropocentric subject. It is a right of access. And I think that dialectics, this definition by negation in a hierarchy that sees the species of anthropos at the center, is being displaced by the combined effects of this great scientific revolution that we are going through and the social economic consequences of this revolution. Because if it is true that we have this understanding of life as surplus, life as the capital that cognitive capitalism is trading on and the universities are absolutely investing in, it is equally true that the social repercussions of the speedy, enormously fast changes are problematic, to say the least. The OECD report that came out a couple of months ago indicates that as a result of our artificial intelligence and robotics industry, we will be looking at the suppression of something like 60 million jobs by 2030, like tomorrow morning. 60 million jobs in advanced societies. We know what the digital gap is in terms of race, of age, of ability, and the social implications of this enormous technological exchange are devastating and absolutely top of the agenda, not for our governments, but certainly for our scholarly communities. And of course, the Anthropocene, about which more in a minute. Climate change, the suffering, the groaning of the planet under the sustained, the effort to sustain what it costs to carry such a scientific revolution. We are caught between the fourth industrial revolution and the sixth extinction at the same time. And thinking these two things, the fourth industrial revolution and the sixth extinction, at the same time, is a headache, to say the least. You cannot do that within the linear logic that we are taught in the social and the human sciences. And I want to concur completely with Professor Descola's point that the categories that we have inherited, the categories of analysis that we've inherited particularly from social constructivist methods, do not apply to what is going on. And what is going on is not the effect of some external paranoid source, it's us. And cognitive capitalism, c'est nous. It's the product of our intelligence, it's the product of our efforts. Within this, then, the dialectics of difference are being restructured, and we are looking at a great opportunity to reformulate how we would reconstruct what happens between man and his others. And here, the question of what counts as the basic unit of reference for the human is absolutely crucial. I started my posthuman book by saying we are not all human in the same way or to the same degree, and we do not take the same point of reference to define our humanity. As females of the species, and I remember a book by Catherine MacKinnon just a few years back saying, are women human? If you look at the history of attributing humanity to the females of any species, we were not excluded from education until the 1950s for nothing. The women were excluded from education because we were not supposed to have any intelligence for education. According to Aristotle, we lack the higher levels of the speculative soul. We are human enough to produce human children, but not human enough to actually be trained for theology, for philosophy, for the great endeavors of the human spirit. Virginia Woolf couldn't access university, Simone de Beauvoir couldn't access L'École Normale. We are talking about yesterday morning. So the effort to be fully human, indigenous, Black, non-European, the racialized others. How human are they? Let's look at race theory, the work of Gilroy, the work of Césaire, the great Francophone school of postcolonial theory. What is human in a colonized subject? And there's so much criticism of posthumanism coming from postcolonial theory, saying for, as people we've never been human enough, and how could we possibly become posthuman? And we embrace our humanity, something that is still to come. Perfectly strong arguments, although I would have my counter-argument that we are all caught between the fourth industrial revolution and the sixth extinction, and we here is a planetary category. Now, animals, planetary, Earth, others, are primary victims of what T. Grace Atkinson, a great American feminist, in 1974 called the metaphysical cannibalism of the dominant subject. And because cannibalism has come back into the discussion through the work of Philippe d'Escola and the work of Viveiro de Castro on indigenous epistemology, I wanted to give you this little gem that metaphysical cannibalism, 1974, came in as a feminist critique of this voracious violence that the dominant subject attributed to himself to actually organize differences hierarchically and dialectically. So the posthuman moment of convergence is a great opportunity to undo this, to renegotiate a number of social symbolic relationships by looking at man as simultaneously the representative of a specific species, Anthropos, and a kind of standard bearer for the universal, Homo sapiens, Homo universalis. It is really quite a contradiction in terms to even speak of rational animal. But in my discipline and philosophy, this is such a kind of foundational principle that you really touch it at your own risk and peril. And I have studied very much at the Sorbonne. I am a French philosopher by training. I spent my youth not far away from Philippe at Vincennes, following the seminars of Deleuze, of Sixou, of Lyotard. So I have inherited from French philosophy an understanding of life as ontologies and processes, process ontologies of life, or people call it also continental naturalism. And I have learned from Serre, from Deleuze, to look at living system as processes in a non-deterministic manner, vital materialism, and only one matter, intelligent and self-organizing. And you don't have to go to immediately to non-European sources to defend it. You find this absolutely lucidly in the philosophy of Spinoza, particularly if you reread Spinoza with the French school, with Deleuze, with Balibar, with Matteron, with the philosophers that since the 1970s have prepared an alternative to Hegelian Marxist dialectics by turning to Spinoza, naturalism, a naturalistic ontology. Only one matter. We are all variations on that theme or as Deleuze would say, we're all modulations of that. Contemporary science, if you say this to the people working on stem cells or genetics, they say, but of course we are. Where have you been for the last 30 years? Under a rock? Only in the humanities and social sciences is the exceptionalism of the human subject as a transcendental consciousness such a foundational principle that it is untouchable. It is the rational animal endowed with language and consciousness. Everything else is other, i.e. worth less than. The convergence that we're going through, which I call the posthuman convergence, throws this open. It is a great opportunity to redefine this, and the relationship to what used to be the animal is at the core of it. Let's think for a moment about ways in which this relationship to animals has been structured, always within my disciplines, and then from there, how we can rethink otherness outside this hierarchical, dialectical system. There is an intimacy, a familiarity between animals and humans. Anthropology has done and is doing amazing work on this. There's an intimacy that can become quite comical. Deleuze used to say that there are three types of animals: those that you watch televisions with, those that you eat, and those that you're scared of. It's a very good way of describing. Lying on the sofa next to your pet, eating whatever used to be crawling outside your windows, and being entertained by the likes of King Kong, or Jurassic Park dinosaurs, or avatars. This familiarity and estrangement at the same time, in this kind of twilight zone where human meets non-human within our highly urbanized, technologized societies. But right of access, hierarchy. Derrida calls it carno-phallo-logocentrism. Yes, darling, I will eat you. It's just a question of time. I will consume you. And for Derrida, as for all Derridians, and here I'm thinking of a really strong posthumanist that I admire greatly, Carrie Wolfe, for anybody working within a Derridian framework, there is a continuum between the critique of humanism and the critique of anthropocentrism. Anybody working in a more materialist framework with Deleuze and Serre would be a little bit more careful. If you're looking at the genealogies, you can do critiques of humanism and never really encounter species supremacies. I would go even further. In the humanities and social sciences, you're not at all encouraged to think of yourself as a species being. Darwin is really missing from the categories of critical analysis. We have ample Freud, ample Marx, and Nietzsche, we got doses of. Darwin is missing. We do not think of ourselves in the humanities in species terms. We don't even have the language for it, let alone the mindset. If you're looking at the scholarship, the critiques of anthropocentrism are coming from very different disciplines, anthropology, all of science studies, race theory, ecofeminism, but critiques of humanism are coming from inside the humanities. And maybe the specificity of humanism is that it engenders its own critiques. I'm quoting here Edward Said, that you can criticize humanism in the name of humanism and never touch anthropocentrism. And I think these two strands, the convergence between the two, is what makes our moment particularly interesting, because now we can no longer avoid the confrontation with what used to be the animal others, knowing what we know about our own constitutions, our own genetic makeup, our own evolutionary itineraries. Yes, man, the rational animal, but this rational animal can no longer rely on the animal to define himself by negation. Or as John Mularkey puts it very wittily, we have to stop metaphorizing the animal as the other. The animal is an index of death for Derrida, an index of life for Deleuze, an index of dehumanization for Agamben, and so on and so forth. Even in philosophy, the animal is providing extra services. And that takes me to the second big function. So we have this intimacy, which is a form of consumption. The second modal relation is metaphorizations. Animals have spelled out a social grammar of virtues and moral distinctions. They are moral reference for human qualities. We've all read Molière and Lévy. They are metaphorical habits that really wrap up the animals into a human moral kind of dictionary, not a dictionary that Byrne would approve of, I am sure. Since science studies took off, I'm thinking of the early Donna Haraway work, these infantilizing narratives, these moralizing narratives have really been deconstructed. But just think of fairy tales and animals and the role that they play in conveying essential social codes, in disciplining and punishing. It seems to me that this metaphorical function is one of the first things that we need to look at and get rid of in the present context. This is no longer a matter of representation. It's a matter of ontologies, of process ontologies, where our own being in the world, parts of territories coexisting with other non-human animals, is really the question of the day, whether you look at climate change, whether you look at sustainability issues, whether you look at what we are learning about our genetic makeup and how we got to where we are through cooperative, symbiotic systems of cooperation with a multitude of non-human others. The next big mode of relation to animals is labor. I think if you look at how humans have exploited and continue to exploit animals for labor, from the obvious ones, transportation, food, to cosmetics and fashion, it's really a matter of a zooproletariat. The true time has provided and continues to provide labor with their own force, but also through their bodies. We are really consuming their skins and their horns and the wool, their fats. They are almost like a supply of resources and energy that we take for granted. And I think the political economy of this mode of consumption of the labor force of animals is again being completely redefined by science and technology. Since Dolly the sheep, transgenic animals are now being recomposed in our laboratories and through our stem cell and genomic research. We are creating species that are already programmed to fulfill certain labor functions. The oncomouse of Donna Haraway, the totemic animal that is created in order to produce spare parts for sick human beings, is the beginning of a new cosmology whereby transgenic animals are actually spare parts for the living. And there are new species that we are bringing into being. Same with the rewilding mechanisms that we're putting back, bringing back extinct species. And we tried a couple with disastrous results, if I read the first reports. Rewilding, bringing back species that had been extinct through our genomics research. These are massive interventions that are actually allowing us, in a sense, to fabricate transgenic species a way that challenges our God-given right to use and abuse the animals of this, the bodies of these others. So for me, a post-anthropocentric moment, a post-human moment, would undo this fake, spurious intimacy, the laziness of the mental habits of metaphorization, and the ruthless labor exploitation, and allow us to look at a new territorialization of our relationships to the multitude of post-animal, post-animality is one of the terms that we have used in the post-human glossary that we have just produced. If we are post-human, well, they are post-animals. And I think we could then describe the moment that we're going through as at least a challenge of this ideal, the humanist, lily-white, drop-dead gorgeous, perfectly bodied, even the haircut is good, unbelievable, Vitruvian men, as far as I'm concerned, the man of reason that has simply been, since the Enlightenment, both individually and culturally, the standard of perfection, of perfectibility. Now, this, in speaking like this, you, I hope I'm very honest about this, you will hear the echoes of my French training. I did study with Foucault, I did study with Deleuze, I did study with Irigaray. I have absorbed heavy doses of anti-humanism in a very productive manner, not in any inhumane or cheap, you don't care for humanity. No, distance, critical distance from this man of reason that claims to be the universal and yet is what there is of more specific in the world. This is a white male European, or as Lucy Rigueret said in 1976 in Speculum of the Other Woman, it's a man, it's a white guy. Okay, the universal, well, depends completely on how huge your ego is and how disembedded your thinking can be. If we are embedded and embodied, if we start from somewhere specific, taking the politics of experience seriously, this is a highly cultural and specific ideal. It's full of great things, it's not all bad, but it has to be brought to accountability. How can we imagine jumping from that to a vision of homo universalis that would have totally different reference? And I'm very grateful to Donna Haraway for pointing out this fantastic picture. Can we imagine that the measure of all things is a very different set of premises with a decentering of the species? And, you know, it's funny and it's comical, but if you look at our robotic industry and the people working on artificial intelligence, it is quite obvious that they are cloning the neural system of multiple species other than the human. And our sense of smell, our scent, is practically dead because of pollution, because we don't go hunting and gathering anymore. So it is the scent of dogs that is being used for robotics and for the scanners, machines that go into, you know, difficult areas to sniff the problem or to sniff diseases or whatever. We can't defeat gravity. We don't have sonar. We don't have radar. So bats and dolphins and insects are coming in, providing essential information for our robotic industry and artificial intelligence. So the descent, again, I'm repeating, the decentering of the centrality of Anthropos is a feature of our science, of our technology, and consequently of cognitive capitalism, that is, that needs to make quick profits. So if the human body is an obsolete type of machine, well, you know, we go and get clone the forces and aptitude of other species. And I think, so this is kind of comical, but it has a hard core of painful truth that the decentering of the human is a factor of our historicity. It's something that is happening, and it should be a liberating and exhilarating experience, and it should not plunge us into melancholia or into nostalgia for this guy. Somewhere between this, I'll come back to this, and this, somewhere in here, we need to trace a new road, and that is, for me, the posthuman challenge. I repeat, the philosophies of life on naturalistic ontologies of French philosophy, Deleuze, Serre, very important here, and before them, their supervisors. Both Deleuze and Serre were supervised by Bachelard, an extremely interesting philosopher of life, and of course, Georges Canguilhem, terribly important for Foucault, taught Foucault the little, admittedly, Foucault knows about the history of science. Think of that other French philosophy, not only the revolutionary May 68 thing, but the philosophy of science, with a relationship to life and the materiality of life that makes French philosophy since the 18th century, since my favorite, Denis Diderot, a really interesting tradition that I would love you to kind of give a second chance to. Quickly, a few methodological remarks before I ease out and we can go into the discussion. Asking to think in those terms, to make the transition from the comfort of this ideal anthropocentrism to this, is asking a lot. Is asking a great deal because it is asking to take on the change and the pain of this change. And this is particularly difficult, again, for people in the humanities and the social sciences. And my recent work has been about what is human about the humanities. And in the humanities, we are not trained, as I said before, to think of ourselves as species being, nor are we trained to think in terms of species in critical theory. Just run the basic exercise. Go in front of the mirror and recite the mantra of critical theory. I am against capitalism, yes. I am against sexism, yes. I am against heteronormativity, yes. I am against racism, yes. I am against the human species. Oops. Not the same. It would not even occur. Although, if you look at our posthuman glossary, you will find a serious contingent of abolitionists led by the philosopher Patricia McCormack, who wants to abolish the category of the human species altogether. They're called the ahumans, and they want to abolish the category and get on to a world of multi-species. But they are very much a punk, admittedly, minority. For most of us, there is an attachment to Anthropos that runs through whatever critical theory, critical practice you may have. And my dialogue here is very strongly and passionately with my postcolonial race theorist brothers, with Paul Gilroy, with whom I edited a book called Conflicting Humanities, where we compare notes on what do you mean by humanity, depending on what your starting point is politically and in terms of discipline, with Achille Mbembe, who is a very acute critic of cognitive capitalism in terms of blackness. And then we have this discussion of how far are we prepared to take our distance from the category. And disidentification with the anthropocentric category is asking a lot. And you will find a lot of postcolonial theory saying we critique him. In a sense, that's easy. There's quite a broad consensus. But to jump to a worldview like this, knowing that there are animistic and indigenous epistemologies that start from the animal, and Philippe Descola and the work of Vivero de Castro shows the crucial importance of an animal-centered, earth-centered perspective in non-European cosmology and ontologies, knowing that the aboriginal, the indigenous, the animistic are just waiting around the corner, a lot of people are shrinking back. And we're getting a very interesting combination that is an analytical form of post-anthropocentrism, which, however, upholds humanistic principle. An analytic model of post-anthropocentrism means accepting that intelligence, knowledge production, and thinking today is not the prerogative of humans alone. It is done by computational networks. It is extended across the animal kingdom, or as Stacey Alamo puts it in her works on trans species, thinking is the stuff of the world. The container for thinking is not just the human mind, not in the age of algorithms and computational networks. And so we accept this, and accept that there is a kind of an extended vision of distributed consciousness. But when it comes to putting values on it, we go back to him. The example that I have of this is the transhumanist. And the temple of transhumanists is nothing less than the University of Oxford, which has created, because it's Oxford, we think big, an Institute for the Future of Humanity. And the Institute for the Future of Humanity is run by an incredibly intelligent, very, very competent person called Nick Bostrom. And the project of Nick Bostrom is to start from distributed consciousness, computational networks, and the speed and efficiencies of algorithmic thinking in order to improve him, to bring the human species to a higher levels of performance. This is called the Human Enhancement Project. The research program is called Super Intelligence. It's Oxford. It has millions in research funding. Anybody looking for a PhD position, go there immediately, postdocs. It's almost as good as the Anthropocene at HKV, enormously well-funded. And Bostrom is very, very strong in saying, analytically, I am a posthumanist. I can see that computational networks are doing all the thinking. But when it comes to norms and values, I want to improve the human species, enhance human intelligence through chips, through transplant, through interaction with the new computer systems, making sure that our brain, which at the moment is slower than our algorithm, than our computational system, that our brain can accelerate and be as fast as the machines that we have produced. It's not science fiction, it's Oxford, go and Google it, it's happening right here and right now, and it's science. It's what Deleuze calls royal science, well-funded royal society science. So the combination here is analytically post-anthropocentric, normatively neo-humanist. If any of you are looking for grants, this is the equation that you need to run. You don't want to be a critical post-humanist like me that says the opposite, says we are analytically post-anthropocentric. So let's be coherent and be post-human in our ethics as well. We need to take this opportunity to rethink our relationship to otherness, to take it out, disextricate it from the universalism, the hierarchies, the dialectics of devalorized difference. Here is a chance of becoming intelligent, of being coherent, of being of here and now. Critical posthumanism, the line that I run, is, I think, a kind of a love letter to the present. What a fantastic world, and what a mess. At the same time, fourth industrial revolution, sixth extinction, at the same time. But it is embracing it in order to bring it to a different level. It's not going to get you the grant, so be careful with it, but keep it in mind that that is the way to go. I think have I got another 5 minutes burned, or am I over already? Quickly? Okay, because I wanted to have a dig at the Anthropocene. I cannot not have a dig at the Anthropocene, at the Hakave. So you know where I would like to go? Sorry? Okay, I just said I have one slide. The Anthropocene and the shift, so the exclusive emphasis and focus on the planet and climate change is a very important, but in my opinion, partial way to go about the mutation that the posthuman convergence is calling upon us. And the Anthropocene is a very complicated notion which has exploded, and this is my present for Bernd, in the anthropo-meme. It has spun off a number of sub-concepts, the Capitalocene, the Thulocene, the Anthropocene, the Anthropocene, the Plasticine, the Plantinocene, the Misanthropocene, and if you have more, please send them in because I'm collecting them. It has already become a meme. It has already been caught in the spinning movements of cognitive capitalism. It's already feeding back in a number of reterritorialization that allow the same forces that have caused the pollution and the contamination to actually continue to exist under the heading of the Anthropocene. I would prefer to connect the Anthropocene to issues of redefining subjectivity and otherness in the context of a lucid embracing of the condition that we're in, knowing that it is our world, it is our intelligence, it is us, it's not an alien other. And this philosophy is called the philosophy of immanence, and embracing what we have in order to transform it, I think, is a gesture both of love for the world and a little bit a challenge to make the world do better than we've been able to do so far. So animality, post-animality, humanimals, on the path to a mutation that needs to be social and symbolic and not only scientific. I am a pathological optimist. I think we can do it. Thank you.